This is Brandon Janice, and you're listening to Sick Empire. Episode 3, The Survivors, Mental Health in the Black Community. When I was 17, I was driving from my tiny suburban town in Michigan to Detroit, and I was pulled over by the highway patrol. I was speeding, no doubt about it, and my plates were expired. So I ended up getting 2 tickets. They were not my first. I had accumulated plenty of tickets for minor traffic violations, but they had all been dismissed. So when I went to court for this particular incident, I'm thinking that the tickets would be dismissed and I would get on with my day. But the judge had seen that this was not my first rodeo, and she sentenced me to attend a collection of classes called Safety First or something like that to make me a more responsible driver. Now, I can't recall anything about the course except that I was required to attend 1 reckless driver's class in order to pass the entire course and straighten everything out with the courts. So the classes were held sporadically throughout the week, so I just picked one and went without reading the description at all. Now, the class I chose was at an old community center, and I remember going into the room where the chairs were all in a circle. Not one of the chairs matched each other, and there was a party table set up with donuts from a Michigan bodega called Quality Dairy. I remember grabbing an old-fashioned donut and taking a seat. And as people filled the space, I noticed that I was the youngest person in the room, and I was definitely the only person who was from the suburbs. So before the introductions, I was under the impression that I was going to be in a class with other students who were also being punished for speeding or smoking pot while driving, but the folks in that particular reckless driving course were all recovering addicts or alcoholics trying to get their licenses back after a slew of DUIs. But the plot thickens. That reckless driving course that I had chosen was actually designed to function as a therapy group. And people went to express their fears, talk about depression, anxiety, mental health traumas, and things like that. And as a young teenager, I had never been to therapy. And I had honestly never really openly talked about mental health. And then when it was my turn to introduce myself, I said my name and that I had been speeding. And then there was silence. Like, everyone was waiting on me to say something deeper. But I couldn't. I was really scared of being seen when I was younger. I felt like I was hiding in plain sight, like I was a shell of myself. So the room is silent, and everyone just waited for me to take the floor. I was the last person to introduce myself after the rest of the group, you know, went around the circle, and some people had shared some really heavy stuff. So I remember getting out my phone and ignoring the obvious opportunity to show up. And the lady who was leading the meeting finally asked me if I wanted to share something. And I said something like, I'm just here to get my ticket thrown out. I don't want to share my problems with y'all. I don't have y'all problems. I was a bratty teenager. And the lady said, and this was the last thing she said to me throughout the whole class, she said, you may not share the same problems. Your problem is that you can't share your problems. And she had read me right. And that fear of vulnerability that I was called out for as a teenager turned out to be a major topic of discussion in therapy sessions that I've sat through as an adult. And there's plenty to unpack about vulnerability and its connection to mental health, but the heroes of that story I just shared are the people who were in the class, who did share their deep fears and shameful past, and who were all committed to turning their lives around and committed to getting better, committed to healing their mental health conditions and becoming more than a diagnosis. You know, I'll never forget a woman saying in that course that since she had been taking therapy, she learned that her DUI wasn't about driving under the influence, but it was about being depressed under the influence. And I'm telling you this story to set the stage for today's episode. And in true Sick Empire fashion, the guests on today's show are quite different from one another. However, they are fighting the same fight to help heal Black neighborhoods that are oftentimes overlooked, overprescribed, and underserved when it comes to mental health. Our first guest is Kamisha L. Jones. She is the founder of Sister Ossia Community Wellness in Chicago. Listen to her describe how the lack of services available to her when she was battling a personal mental health condition inspired her to open up her own wellness center on the south side of Chicago.
I started Sister Ossia out of my own experience of living with a mental health condition and not really seeing anything out there that centered the experiences of young Black women from a community support standpoint. Sister Ossia Community Mental Wellness is located in Chicago on the South Side, and we focus on making mental wellness affordable, accessible, and culturally centered for Black women. And we provide individual therapy, group therapy, workshops, social events, all with the focus of bringing young Black women together to not just heal themselves, but for us to collectively heal together as a community.
Can I ask you where you got the name from?
Yes. So Sister Ossia, it has its roots in a couple of things. So when I was looking for a name, I wanted it to be something that was unapologetically Black, but also focused on healing. So Sister is a word that we use within the Black community. It's a word of endearment. It's a word that we use to communicate connection to one another. Ossia is a Swahili word that means to be free of psychological and physical illness. So together, Sister means a Black woman, and then Ossia is experiencing freedom from psychological and physical illness.
That's beautiful. I'm curious to know if you are the first person in your family to do this type of work, or do you come from a background where people regularly talk about mental health?
I am the first in my family to do this type of work in the mental health field. I do have people in my family who are in the helping profession. My aunt is a counselor. My grandparents were teachers. So we do have, you know, a history of helping other people, explicitly stepping out, you know, to create a whole, you know, organization or dedicating a part of my purpose work to mental health. I am the first in my family and the first in my family that I know of to actually go to therapy.
I asked Kamisha, does she feel at home doing this healing work? Here's what she had to say.
Doing this community healing work is definitely something that is natural to me. I am a licensed clinical social worker, and anybody who knows anything about social work knows that you don't go into this profession like just as something to do. Like, you really have to believe in supporting people, especially those who are on the margins. And even in addition to that, knowing that you can be able to be transformative in this field as well. So social work, you know, going into the field, people are like, oh, why do you want to do that? You're not going to make any money. You're going to be working with people who are on the margins and all those different things. But that didn't matter to me. And it's something that to me comes pretty easy. And I think what makes my story a little bit unique is that I live with a mental health condition. So I know how it feels to navigate the mental health care system. I know what at least I see is missing from the mental health care field in general, especially as it relates to Black women. And so I think having that personal experience and having kind of like the professional education makes the work that I do at Sister Ossia very different, because there are people who start, you know, organizations or platforms who don't necessarily have that lived experience. So I think part of why I love the work that I do at Sister Ossia and why we've been impactful is because we have people who have a lived experience and who love the work that they do, and they understand the importance of it, and it's something that they're dedicated to.
Can I ask you, what are some of the transformations that you've seen in the community? Because you're doing this on the South Side of Chicago, right? You know, I got to be honest, there is a huge difference in therapy that even privileged Black folk receive versus the communities in Detroit and versus the communities in Atlanta and on the South Side of Chicago. Can you talk to me about some of the transformations that you've witnessed, if any, at all yet?
Mm-hmm. Chicago is actually a very unique place when it comes to mental health for a variety of reasons. One, Chicago is probably still one of the most segregated cities in the country. And with segregation comes a lack of divestment in resources and institutions that can serve the community. About 10 years ago, they shut down like 8 mental health clinics in majority Black and Brown neighborhoods, which are on the south and west sides of the city. So that created a crisis in the city as it relates to mental health care. So individual organizations or private institutions or community groups had to really kind of pick up the pieces of having such a divestment into mental health care in the city. So since then, there have been many organizations that have started in Chicago, a lot of them focused on the South Side and the West Side, that are led by Black people. And that's something that isn't really known. Chicago is, there's a lot of great work happening in the city as it relates to mental health care. But one of the transformations is, as time has progressed, there's been more and more young Black people like myself who have started organizations, who are organizing, who are really providing services to fill that gap and to address the mental health care crises in the city. The other thing about being on the South Side is that there aren't a lot of mental health organizations on the South Side. So in the neighborhood where we're located in South Shore, if you go on Yelp or Psychology Today, there are only like 5 other providers in South Shore, and the neighborhood probably has 50 to 60,000 people, and that's one neighborhood on the South Side. There just aren't as many mental health care organizations or institutions on the South Side. So a part of what Sister Afia has been able to do that has, I believe, has been impactful is that we have, one, made all of our services low cost because we understand that that is one of the top barriers that prevent African Americans from being able to get care is cost. And we also have worked with other organizations or practitioners on the South Side. So before we had our office, we would have events all over the South Side. So Bronzeville, Hyde Park, Inglewood, Washington Park, South Shore, Chatham, Auburn Gresham. We were able to really integrate with communities because we were showing up in all these neighborhoods, doing these different events, meeting different people. And if you talk about mental health in Chicago or specifically Black women, Sister Afia is known because we've really been embedded in the community and we've been able to reach over 700 young Black women up until 2020. And then this year, thus far, we probably have served about 500, right? And that's a lot of people if you think about it. So that's the transformation that we've seen. One, on a city level of just like young Black people doing this great work that a lot of people don't know about in regards to mental health. And then us kind of being a unique organization and also kind of helping to remove some of those additional barriers. Because like you said, mental health care is usually something that people who can access it are middle income or upper middle income people, even within the Black community. But what we've done is tried to make mental health care for everybody. And that's something that is really important to myself and my team to be able to do because we know it's extremely important, especially on the South Side of Chicago, especially in segregated Chicago.
Now listen to Kamisha talk about how the pandemic has affected her work in the community.
Nothing changed too much. We were able to move everything online. There's been an increase, of course, in people seeking services. We've also have in some ways always been in high demand just because we're one of the few organizations that actually provide low-cost services. With the pandemic, it's been even more people. So we had to like hire another therapist. We're probably going to hire another one at the end of the year. One of the other interesting things with moving online, now we have a larger community. So before, a sister support group, it was very Chicago-based, like only Chicagoans could go because it was in person. But with moving things online, like we had sister support group Sunday, and we had someone from New York, we had some people from Ohio, we had some people from California. So what the pandemic has also done is it's also broadened our communities.
That must feel good, though. That must feel like a good problem to have.
Yeah, it's definitely a good problem. The thing that we just constantly run into is that there are so many people who need services, who specifically want to come to us for services, and being able to meet that need is probably still the hardest thing, because we can't, of course, serve all of Chicago, but we hate turning people away. And that's probably one of the things that have been a little bit more challenging, is having to do that.
Do you see more qualified Black social workers like going into the field, getting into the field, opening up community centers?
I would say I am seeing more Black women going into private practice for and offering therapy. I'm in a couple of Facebook groups where it's a decent amount of Black women who are opening like their own practices to provide therapy. Now, if they're providing sliding scale or low cost, I'm unsure of that, but I am seeing more people do that. The other thing is that the trajectory to actually being like a licensed mental health professional is a long trajectory. So some people may be interested in doing it, but because the trajectory of from when you start school to actually being fully licensed is kind of a long journey, some people were like, oh, well, you know, I'm not going to do that, right? So I think that there are more people who are interested in being therapists. It's still a journey that you have to really be committed to. So like you go to undergrad for 4 years and you go to graduate school for 2 years. Then you get supervised for 2 to 3 more years, and then you can apply and take a test, and you have to pass the test to be licensed. So it's about, from start to finish, about a 7 to 8 year journey.
I have to ask you, Kamisha, isn't it worth it? What are your thoughts on Black people exclusively talking to Black therapists when it comes to mental health? One of the reasons I asked is, do you remember that show Girlfriends? And there, it was about three characters, I think, on the show that had went to therapy. All of their therapists were white. And I remember thinking like, man, I could never have a white therapist. Like, I just can't see myself having to be politically correct and mad. I know it's a long process and I understand that it's 7 years and I get it. It's arduous. However, how important do you think it is for Black women, Black people in general, to kind of exclusively talk to other Black people when it comes to mental health? Like, do you think there is some sort of barrier that is down? Or do you think there's some maybe cultural capital that you get with a Black therapist that you will not get with a non-Black therapist? Like, someone who's in the profession, like, can you talk to me about that idea?
I mean, I definitely think there are benefits for Black people to see Black clinicians for therapy. I definitely think it's extremely beneficial. It's always been here, but it's been highlighted more. Racism and how it impacts us and how it literally impacts us mentally and affects our everyday lives. And so it's easier to have those conversations with a Black therapist on top of other things related to your lived experience as a Black person, in addition to things that are relevant. So at Sister Afia, we use the word culturally centered, meaning that all of our services really focuses on centering Black culture and things that are important to specifically Black women. And I think that's part of the reason why we've been able to reach so many Black women is because of that. So an example would be, we had a group called Liberate that focused on generational trauma. huge issue in the Black community. But the way that we talked about generational trauma was by introducing Black films. So we used Crooklyn and Eve's Bayou, movies such as those to really talk about generational trauma, but from a culturally centered lens. Even myself, when I'm talking to some of my clients, like recommending Black authors, one of my clients, she was really struggling with finding her voice. And I recommended, like, hey, read The Color Purple. That's all what Celie was doing, was trying to find her voice, you know, and really trying to assert herself as a Black woman. So those are the type of things that I feel like people get when you have a Black therapist and you're a part of the Black community. In addition, you don't have to deal with racism and discrimination, because that also happens within the mental health field. And just an example, there was a Yale study where they would have people who had a more African-American sounding name and people who had more of a European sounding name calling these doctors' offices to get appointments. And throughout the study, they found that people who had more of an African-American sounding name did not really get calls back, even close to as much as people who had European sounding names. So those are the type of things that people have to deal with, you know, when they're seeking services, specifically if they're seeking services outside of their race.
I asked Kamisha what she thinks the future of mental health services in the Black community looks like. Here's what she had to say.
One of the things that I see is for our mental wellness communities to be sustainable, regardless of if it has to be linked to any other historically white institution. Us having our own organizations or our own wellness centers, our own practices where we can serve the Black community, and it's not predicated on if we're linked to or receive funding for or need anything necessarily from white folks. So I definitely see that. I do see more and more people just doing the healing work. One of the things that I've seen that's been really beautiful at Sister Afia is we literally have so many Black women who come to us for therapy or groups or workshops who say, I'm going to be a generational curse breaker, right? So what does it look like for, you know, our community to have broken those generational curses, right? And I think millennials and Gen Zs are kind of, they're there, where it's like we want to be the change for healing in our families, in our individual lives, and in our communities. So I see that as definitely being a part of the future. The other thing that I also see being a part of the future as it relates to mental health in the Black community is that it's for everybody. You know, it's not just for the people who have insurance or the people who can do private pay, but anybody, regardless of their socioeconomic background, can access services. Because one of the things that I have seen is in some ways still a lot of people who otherwise wouldn't be able to access mental health care services because of their income status still can't, even though there might be more Black clinicians. So I would love to see, and I think it's moving in a direction where people, regardless of their income, that they can receive mental health care services. And then in addition to that, being able to continually integrate parts of our culture into healing and not just looking at what we learn in grad school from, you know, white theorists or professors, but more emerging scholars within the mental health care field. Like I love Dr. Joy DeGruy, and she talks about post-traumatic slave syndrome. And then Dr. Lonnie Jones, who I've known for a while, she's actually in New York, but she's a professor, and she just came out with a book called Revisioning Therapy for Women of Color. So even seeing more scholars like that come forward to really create discourse about mental health in the Black community. And then also just additional platforms. Like every time I turn around, there's another platform, there's another website, there's another podcast, social media account that focuses on healing in the Black community. And I see that also multiplying as well. So it literally becomes a part of our everyday lives. And it's not something that's just like out there. It's something that's like, oh yeah, like I'm going to see my therapist, or, oh, you know, I'm going to go to this holistic healing workshop. You know, it's normal.
Thanks for tuning in. I'll be right back after a word from the sponsors of this episode. I'm going to interrupt us here to talk about a brand whose entire mission is to help us heal. The brand is called BetterHelp. That's Better, H-E-L-P. And they're an e-counseling platform committed to facilitating therapeutic matches. You can start communicating with a licensed therapist in under 48 hours, and the service is more affordable than traditional offline counseling. Visit BetterHelp/empire. That's Better, H-E-L-P. And join the over 1 million people taking charge of their mental health with the help of an experienced professional. There's a special offer for the listeners of Sick Empire. To get 10% off your first month, visit betterhelp.com/empire. Now you'll hear the story of Salome Araya, a Reiki master and mental health holistic healing practitioner. She's also a spiritual counselor and a healing justice advocate with a strong background in public health. Salome is truly an inspiration to anyone who has ever been misdiagnosed. Don't let her soft voice fool you. Salome is not in the business of sugarcoating or pussyfooting around the labor-intensive journey of healing while Black. Can I ask you, what did this kind of spirituality and healing look like for you growing up?
You know, growing up, my family is from the southern part of the United States and also from East Africa and Ethiopia. And there wasn't a lot of tangible spiritual practices that I recall growing up with. We did start going to a spiritual center in Los Angeles when I was a teenager. So it sort of just opened up my being to, you know, just the universal presence and oneness that we're connected to. And I say, you know, sometimes I say, thankfully, I wasn't born into any sort of religion. So I didn't have to deprogram myself from certain doctrinations that I learned later were just out of alignment with my spirit. As a young adult, though, the personal pain that I went through actually led me to my spiritual awakening multiple times. And that sort of became, in the last 20 years, just my way of life. They say the struggle is deeply connected to spiritual awakening and connection. And I connected deeper with my ancestors. I have always been highly sensitive and intuitive and an empath since I was younger. So there were those sort of aspects happening within me. Just didn't have the language for it.
Can you talk to me about that idea of feeling ancestral connections, especially as a Black woman, right? Especially as a Black American, because it's truly almost impossible to ever be able to trace those connections. But I feel them sometimes so deeply that it's indescribable.
It's everything. I can tell you also that in my work, one of the aspects that happens in my Reiki sessions with people often, if they're ready for it, if their ancestors are present to them in that way, they're able to connect with their ancestors sometimes for the first time. And it just sometimes literally brings me to tears to see people realizing that they're connected to so much more than this physical reality. They're not alone, and that there is a presence guiding them if they just open up to it. When I was in the thick of my pain body and my depression, and I received all these diagnoses from Western medical world, my ancestors came to me during the deepest, darkest times, and they started just connecting with me, whether it was through words or in my dreams or just messages. And I just would get these intuitive downloads. And sometimes I could tell they weren't coming just from my higher consciousness, that they were coming from somewhere else. And I realized that they were for a while trying to actually get my attention. So, you know, sometimes when people are like, oh, I'm feeling voices, or I'm hearing voices, or I feel crazy, quote unquote, or, you know, I'm not really sure what's going on, but there's something moving around in this spiritual space, like above the crown. And it was just so freeing to finally understand like what was actually happening. Like they were trying to come to me, trying to connect with me and communicate me and support me on this journey. And there are times when I'm just moved with so much emotion because I can feel them. There are many different ways to connect with your guides. they come in different forms. Sometimes they will speak to you. Sometimes you will see them. Sometimes you will feel them. Sometimes you'll just feel the presence. Sometimes messages will just appear. Signs will happen. So I think part of our imbalance on this land specifically as people of African descent is if we're not connected to the land fully and we're not connected to our spirits personally and our spiritual guides, we're just in chaos. There's a lot of imbalance that can happen in mind, body, spirit, and energy if we're not grounded in the land and or connected with our spirit guides. You don't necessarily need to connect with every single guide that's ever been in your lineage, because they're also healing things on their journey. So when you're opening up, you want to make sure that it's the ones that are aligned in harmony with where you are trying to be in your wholeness. And of course, you still connect and pray for the other ones. But just in terms of the guides, I think it's the same as in the human experience. Everyone's not meant to be a teacher or a guide, right? So it's the same extension in the spirit world. It might take time. Give it some time and it will come. You just have to trust.
Next, I asked Salome to describe what Reiki is. Here's what she had to say.
You know, it's so funny. Reiki can be explained with like a whole book, or you can just have like the simplest words to describe. So Reiki is energy medicine, and it specifically means spiritual energy, the word Reiki. And Reiki is a hands-on healing modality that can support people in any blockages or stagnation, stored pain or trauma, any imbalances in their mental, spiritual, emotional, physical bodies, as well as ancestral. It can be very intense, or it can be very subtle. Sometimes people will receive specific downloads and clarity and messages. Sometimes they will have a physical shift, you know, something was upsetting them physically, and they have an opening or a healing physically. Sometimes emotionally, things might be trapped in the body or from childhood or ancestrally, and that can be moved. Sometimes there's a lot of spiritual awakening, spiritual connecting. One of the most important things is to just be open to receive whatever you're meant to receive. Sometimes people experience what's called current life regression. So they'll travel back into time within this lifetime. They'll re-experience something and sort of have like a release around it. That's, to me, is one of the most amazing things about it. It's like Reiki essentially allows the body to heal itself. So it's in this ultimate theta meditative space. And then you travel, you know, when the mind is like wandering or the person is like physically awake, it's sometimes hard for the system to flow. So it allows the energy to flow in a different way. And for whatever needs to go, will go. It's not always instant. Sometimes it is. Sometimes people can come and have this deeply powerful transformative experience. And sometimes, depending on if it's a chronic issue or a protracted pain, there might need to be some ongoing support. Sometimes it just feels like magic, to be honest. and energy work is very old and it's very present around the planet. So Reiki is just one way, you know. I don't try to tell people this is the only way you can do energy medicine. You know, for as long as humans have been alive, they've been putting their hands on each other and feeling a shift. But a lot of people have stories of grandma have a headache, grandma put her hands on me, my headache's gone. And there are even ways that people can put their hands on themselves with an intention and feel different, you know. We're just so busy, you know, we don't actually realize that this is what's possible inside of us and that our bodies actually can have a shift like in a moment or within, you know, a short period of time, just with setting an intention and letting go.
Can you talk about the uniqueness, maybe the pureness of Black hands doing that work?
You know, I feel like there's something really sacred about it, and there's something very ancient. So I feel like when we're doing this work, like we're actually activating like grandmother energy. Like I feel like sometimes people tell me that's what they feel when I'm working with them through my hands, but also through a presence. This is ancient. This is a return to us being in our power, and that knowing that we're medicine women, we're essentially channeling, but it's coming from us. It's almost like a loop is happening. So it's like we're opening up our channels to the divine, but we are divine as, you know, African women anyway. And, you know, I've had people who've gone to people who are, I guess for the most part, they'll go to like a white practitioner. And then I will work with them and they say it's just a very different experience. And so one thing I know for sure is that our guides are involved in this work and we can't play with it, you know? So if you're going to someone who, and it doesn't mean you can't go to a white practitioner and still feel something powerful, but sometimes what is happening is like those, their lineage or their guides maybe hasn't atoned for some of the things that they are, their descendants embodying now, and what the people in the past did. And so all of that impacts how the experience feels. Do you understand what I'm saying? Yeah. So I tell people, you have to be sure and make sure that the energy of the person you're working with really resonates. You know, it's gonna change the journey.
I think that a lot of people, a lot of women, a lot of Black women who feel what you're talking about when you're talking about that divine loop, if you will. However, there is something about imposter syndrome that I feel holds a lot of people back. So in that sense, can you talk about, maybe share some humbling moments that you have in this work that maybe helped you get over that idea of, is this who I am? Do I heal people?
One of the things I will say, I use the term healing practitioner. I don't use the term healer. For one, this work is a co-creation. So a person's body and spirit, and they're working with me and our guides to do this work. So I'm not doing this by myself. And that's something that I've always felt. I used to be a little too out of the way, like I'm not doing anything, but I realize I am. I'm supporting a process. I'm reminded in the sense to honor the medicine. And I was laughing because I had an experience recently that I've been doing Reiki for many years now. And I even teach it, right? So I have to, with my students, I have to remind them there are certain things you have to do before you do energy work and after to protect, ground, and cleanse. You can't play with it, you know? But I didn't do that with one session I had recently. And this person was dealing with some strong anxiety. Later, they said they were embodying their parents' anxiety and it was literally stuck in their body. So they were shaking and they were experiencing all this stuff and they retrieved it and released it. And it was beautiful. And they were like, I felt all this energy come out from my solar plexus, which is like the middle of the torso area, come out of my body and spread all around the room. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. You know, people always feel something's being pulled from them or released. And they said, oh, I hope it didn't come all around your house. And I was like, no, it doesn't work like that. It's fine. But after that session, for whatever reason, I think they wanted me to learn a lesson again. I didn't do my proper cleansing, clearing the space. I just didn't do that. And I kid you not, 2 days later, I had what I've never experienced, anxiety attack in that way. And I knew right away that it wasn't my anxiety. And I was like, ooh. So that was very humbling for me. Normally, I do honor the medicine and I protect and ground. But for whatever reason, I didn't do it after this session. I just went on about my night and went to sleep. The anxiety that came from them was in the space. This is powerful medicine.
Now listen to Salome describe her next wellness endeavor. It's a program she has curated to help people along their personal healing journeys. And she calls it Healing at the Root.
This program was actually organically born out of my own personal journey with a mental health diagnosis over a decade ago and feeling unsupported by the medical industrial complex as a person of African descent. And I was diagnosed with what they term bipolar disorder. When they use these terms, there's an energy of permanency that normally comes with it if you take it, you know, if you hold it and say, okay, I am this thing. And I remember I took medication for about a month after I was suffering for many years and then, you know, finally decided to get some help, or so I thought. And I just automatically knew, like my guides were like, this is not your way. I started to research and just look up all these different ways to heal alternatively, holistically, because I wasn't looking for a Band-Aid solution. I wanted to really clear this out, you know? And so basically this program, Healing at the Root, is essentially what I did for myself to heal many, many years ago. And when I say heal, you know, healing comes in layers, it's not linear, but what I used to experience and live with then is no longer at all present. And I cleared it, it's gone. And I transmuted it into something completely different. And it took a lot of work. The work is really for people who've tried different things. And most of the people who come to me have tried everything. So the program is essentially addressing healing from the holistic perspective. We have a co-created healing plan. And I, you know, offer Reiki healing and spiritual counseling, life coaching, holistic center counseling, you know, help with developing practices, tools, behavior and lifestyle change. There's a huge spiritual aspect. My intention with this work, I just really want everyone to know it's possible to really heal this, because we have in our communities, we have like a relationship to suffering and trauma and pain. And like we hold it like it's our baby. And we sometimes don't realize that it doesn't have to stay that way. You know, we're actually taught that this pain is supposed to just be a part of you, and it becomes like an identity sort of thing. It takes consistent effort and support, but it is possible to really heal at many layers. So my vision is for more people to just know that.
Being a survivor of the medicine, if you will, the pills or whatever, the medication, almost being a survivor of that, I wonder if you ever feel any type of shame or embarrassment. I'm asking you that, but I think I'm just projecting. I think sometimes when I talk about maybe my own mental health, that's what I feel. And I guess I'm wondering, as someone who not only practices as a healing practitioner, but also teaches, I'm wondering like if you ever feel that when you're discussing your own mental health, not only just because it's so personal, but because you work as a healing practitioner, right? That's your profession. So maybe, I guess, that idea of admitting that you're not well, or you were not always well, do you ever feel any type of way about that?
You know, that's a good question. No, you know why? Because I healed it. I think that's I get excited about sharing the story. And one thing I've learned about specifically in the States, whether it's the medical complex, educational system, politics, even religion, the power is outside of the self, right? So once you realize like, oh wait, like I can heal, this could actually change, you know? I want to tell everybody what my diagnosis was and how I'm moving now, because I know that it provides some sort of hope, and that's all I want to do. Because I feel like the way people understand mental health, specifically in this country, I think is really missing a huge element. The medical field, they just don't even have the language to understand fully what's happening inside of a spirit's body. You know what I mean? So I think for me, it's like, oh, you can say I'm bipolar, but oh, I had like healing abilities, and I needed to, you know, ground with nature more, and I needed to not eat these foods that exacerbate depression. And, you know, the trauma was held in my body. So your way of approaching it is not going to actually help me clear this. There's so many elements that go into it. The environment alone, you know, like social media, there's so many things that we take in that cause us to be sick, but we can change that. You know, it's just like, you can be told you have this thing. If you want to hold it and tuck it in and put it in your belly, you can have it. Or you can be like, nope, I'm going to transmute and shift this, you know? And it's amazing. We're doing magic here, because that's where we come from. Like, we come from magic. That's, to me, us being in our power. Like, to me, that's the revolution, you know, like healing ourselves and knowing what we have access to. And it doesn't have to cost a lot of money. Yeah, I could go on, but yeah, I get really hyped up around this, as you can see.
I'm really glad you kind of segued there, because when I hear you talking about access, I read somewhere that a staggering number, a staggering percentage of kids in the hood, kids in the inner city, are are misdiagnosed with whatever it is, ADHD or anxiety, whatever. They're oftentimes, it's not to say that there aren't mental health, you know, problems in underserved communities, but it is to say that I believe a lot of the times it's easier for people who are not from the community, who don't live in the community, are only servicing the community on a public health level. Sometimes it's easier to slap on a label, you know, what it looks like most from the textbooks or whatever. Can you talk a little about the project that hopefully will bring more access to these holistic mental health ideas that you're talking about, the access to people who generally wouldn't have them?
Yeah, I mean, and just to speak to the diagnosis that you're talking about, it speaks to that idea that, like, there's more things that are happening inside of a body. Like, if a child is having anxiety, maybe they were eating something that's causing it. Maybe they learn in a different way. Maybe there's something in the classroom and they're highly sensitive. This child is just highly sensitive, and they think in a nonlinear way, and they need to be stimulated creatively. They don't have ADHD. I think it suffocates people when you just label them as such. And obviously when you give them medication, that many people speak to actually making things worse. I don't knock medication fully. I do know that some people need it and some people use it as a part of an integrative approach, which is amazing. You know, once you understand which ones work for you and don't make you feel worse. I think my concern is the quick diagnosis, overdiagnosis, specifically in communities of color. And here, take this stuff. And it really just kind of numbs people out and doesn't, there's no agency in that, you know? Honestly, I feel like there's an aspect of it that, well, it is strategic, but that's maybe another podcast topic. So I had this vision a few years ago that is coming to fruition in its own time, as things do. But I have, you know, in my background in public health and just working internationally and with different communities and disenfranchised communities, like, access is always a big thing. I have been given the opportunity to work with the Center for Health Equity, which is an arm of the Department of Public Health. But the Center for Health Equity is really amazing because they have folks in there that are, like, opening up community programs to include holistic healing. It's just one of the most amazing things, because you know systemically it's just not something that we've seen, you know, where it's like we're gonna pay practitioners to offer this to community for free. It's like an energy exchange. Practitioners need to be compensated, but community can receive this for free. So I was initially, my initial project starting with the Center for Health Equity in Brooklyn and Harlem was to do Reiki clinics, which were individual sessions and holistic counseling and group healing circles to address mental health and chronic pain in the community. Because of COVID, we weren't able to fully do it, but I received the opportunity to do another proposal to actually implement my Healing at the Root program, but at the level of training community practitioners to be able to do the work in this holistic way, specifically around helping people heal. This will take time, right? This will take time for people to first wrap their head around what's possible, and then all learning, and then how to do it, and then how to implement, and then how to go on with your life and have new tools. You know, and that's the point, is that you just go forward and you know how to care for yourself, and you know what contributes to your health in a good way and what does the opposite. I think one of the things that I've realized is, you know, I used to be very much like activist, like the system, blah, boo on the system. But it's like, we can create our alternatives. I think that's important. But a lot of our folks are still connected in communities that do depend on the system. We're not all able to just be out of it fully, if that makes sense. So I think this model is an example of how to still do it. And there's a group in Brooklyn, Liberation Health Strategies, that I know the person who runs that, and they're doing sort of like Brooklyn-wide projects with holistic responses for this same reason, you know, and they're open to it, which is beautiful. You know, I can't knock everything because there are some openings, you know, so it's what's possible. This is the future, that the systems are being exposed, and they're just being honest. Like, we want to do something different, and we have resources right here. I was actually crying when I found out that this was the next step, because You just can't imagine what this journey has been, you know, from basically wanting to die. That's me, like at one point, to just now helping people in this way. If you're able to understand why you came to Earth, like your soul's mission, that's actually another thing to free the system from what we call depression. Because I remember actually asking that question, like, literally, what is the point to be here? And at that point, I didn't have an answer. You know, I hadn't connected to it yet. Once you understand that, then you realize, oh, this is my purpose for being here. It clears so much. A lot of people I work with also are like the first people in their family to do this kind of work. And it's hard. Sometimes they're the only one that they chose to come here and serve that role, right? And it's a lot. It's a lot to carry. But once you say yes, you know, there's a reason for that too. There's a reason for you carrying it and then being the one to clear it.
I'm actually really glad you said that, because this is tricky for me, right? Because I hear you when I hear you say that it's good to clear that lineage out, you know, and to be the first one in your family to go to therapy. What I'm curious about is, can you have both? Can you do both? You know, and how do you do both, I guess? And do you run the risk of disconnecting with, you know, that ancestral power when you do, you know, kind of that, if you accidentally clear out too much, you know, like.
That's funny. No. And I mean, again, the thing is, the lineage work has to do with the living family as well. And it doesn't mean that you have to work directly with them. So it's like, let's say there's certain patterns or beliefs or things that you learned, behaviors, things that were passed down cyclically, trauma is handed down. Everybody's handing down their pain, right? So it's clearing out that stuff. I can tell you that's one of the hardest aspects of this work, because the conditioning within the family is really strong. And sometimes people actually have to set boundaries, you know, or they start to really see how they're engaging in certain things that are keeping them imbalanced and unwell. But then they see that they learned it, and that person learned it from that, you know, that grandparent to that great grandparent. So it's like not continuing the unhealthy trauma or pain that is just carried and carried and carried. So it's not to disconnect, it's to actually help make it all healthier.
It's that idea of, like, you know, releasing what no longer serves you.
Exactly. Yeah. But you don't really, you know, the thing is, it's so interesting. We don't realize what you're walking with. So much of this is happening in the subconscious at the level that is not accessed with the conscious mind. There are things that once people start to realize, you pay attention. Oh, wait, I didn't realize I even did that. And I didn't realize that why I did it either, you know. And then you start to see, and then you catch it, and then you change it. Oh, okay, now I'm going to respond differently. Oh, still a little bit left, you know, so it's like a process. You have to literally catch and shift it. And a lot of us didn't learn that. A lot of us learned to self-sacrifice, you know, or to push down the pain. Don't talk about it. You know, don't feel it. All the things we learned, I think we're unlearning now. And we're like, hey, you got to feel it to heal it. So when you're healing, it can hurt, you know, sometimes you're reliving things. But the point is to not just keep telling the story, not just keep talking about it, not just, you know, not hold it. And that, to me, I think, is the difference with the holistic approach. Because we can psychoanalyze our pain. We can all write books about it. And then what, you know? So it's like, now we move it. Now we change the story. Now we let it go. And sometimes there's actual resistance in the body from letting something go. I've had people say they felt themselves pulling something back in. So it's crazy, but it's because we're conditioned to just hold our pain. You know what I mean?
I'm excited to watch your journey and watch you develop, and more specifically, watch what you bring to communities that need you, right? I think that a lot of the times work can usually, like, be for yourself, accolades or money or whatever. And that may be very well true in this work as well. However, I feel in my heart and in my mind that the work that you're doing is going to be much more beneficial to the communities that you work with, the small Black girls, poor Black girls that you work with, who when they meet you and when they see you and when they understand and realize and truly, truly accept the fact that you exist and they can be it too, I think that that is the sweet spot, right? Like, that is your work. You know, the main takeaway from this episode is that you choose how you heal. There is no rule book saying that you have to tattoo a label on your forehead just because a doctor gave it to you. Listening to Kamisha talk about how she is the first person to even see a therapist in her family, and now she is offering mental health services to one of the most misunderstood communities in this country, says to me that a diagnosis is only the beginning of a healing journey for your entire community. Listening to Salome talk about collaborating with the Department of Health to offer free meditation and Reiki courses in Brooklyn says to me that there is a way to navigate the waters of wellness whether you are privileged or poor. These women are selfless. They could have accepted their healing as a blessing and moved on with their lives. But instead, they chose to offer treatment practices to their communities. And you know, I'm really looking forward to the day where the influencers and the superstars that are admired by millions of Black girls are the folks like Kamisha and Salome, who are not ashamed to speak with power about their vulnerabilities in the name of healing for the greater good. Because the most inspirational and the most authentic stories never come from social media or television. They always, always come from the mouths of the survivors.